Get started. So let's see. So yesterday at lunch, I got some feedback, which was a suggestion that I start each lecture with a joke like Latham did. I'm probably not going to do that for various reasons. One being that I kind of feel like, you know, the jokes ought to have something to do with the material that we're discussing, which is hard to arrange on a regular basis. But at least I can do something today, which is, since we're talking about implementations, which of course is the area where the material of this class most connects with experiment. I guess I can tell a story about a theoretical physicist and an experimental physicist. So these two people, one day they were arguing over whether two quantities, A and B, which one was bigger. And they went back and forth on this for a while. And then, you know, eventually they decided to call it a day. But the experimental physicist said, enough of this arguing. I'm going to just do the experiment. Okay, so he stayed up all night in the lab, working and working and working. And by the time the sun came up in the morning, he had finally finished the experiment. And he had shown that B was bigger than A. Okay. So, you know, after that he was pretty tired, but he still kind of hung around because he was anxious to tell the theoretical physicist what he had found. And so, you know, come noon, the theoretical physicist comes in, and the experimental physicist immediately accosts him and says, I did the experiment. A is bigger than B. I'm so tired, I stayed up all night. Theoretical physicist, yeah, I thought about that too. So yeah, A bigger than B, you say. Yeah, that's really easy to prove. So he gets up to the board and starts writing and writing and writing and writing. And the experimental physicist is watching this for a while, and he gets more and more confused. And then finally he realizes what the problem is. He says, wait, I'm sorry, I stayed up all night, I'm so tired, I misspoke. B is actually bigger than A. And the theoretical physicist stops for a moment and says, oh, well, that's even easier to prove. So you have to bear that in mind whenever I'm talking about any kind of experimental stuff in yesterday and today or elsewhere in the class. OK, so questions. Does anyone have any questions on ion trap or whatever else we've been doing in the class so far? No? OK, so today I wanted to kind of give an overview of a bunch of other implementations and of some of the techniques that are used in these implementations to build quantum computers. So basically, there's kind of an inherent tension that we face trying to build a quantum computer. Because on the one hand, we want to make qubits that are very well isolated from the environment so that they have very low error rates, very long decoherence times. But on the other, well, we need to be able to do two-qubit gates. So we need these qubits to interact with each other. And we need to be able to control them. So we need them to be able to interact with us, both to let us control what gates happen and in order to do the measurements. And so this makes it a bit hard sometimes to find systems that satisfy both of these things. Right? One of them says, well, we have to have very weak interactions. And one says, we have to have strong interactions. But there are systems where the interactions are kind of a very limited type or something that you can control, turn on and off with some ease. And those are the systems that become good candidates for quantum information. So maybe I'll make kind of a chart here. It's not a good chart to start with. So yesterday we talked about the ion trap. And in the ion trap, the qubits are stored as energy levels in electrons. And you know, depending on the exact atom and what lasers the experimentalist wants to use, the energy levels might differ by, you know, different degrees of freedom. It might be angular momentum. It might be just principal quantum number. It might be some, you know, spin, hyperfine level, something like that. So there's a variety of kind of sub categories here that you could pick. But basically, it's just different energy levels. And then the next thing that you need is you need a way to cause these qubits to interact. Right? In the case of the ion trap, we use the phonon mode. Of oscillation in the ions. Remember that? Okay. And so that's a pretty good implementation. I would say it's kind of the leading one right now. So people have built ion traps with up to about 14 qubits, something like that. Although there's always a little bit of uncertainty as to what you actually consider, you know, making a quantum computer with this many qubits and just kind of some preliminary thing. So they've made entangled states of, I think, 14 qubits. And there are other smaller systems where they've done much more kind of complicated circuits. In the ion trap, there kind of are no real fundamental principles to scale up. But based on what I told you so far, there is kind of a limit, which is that in a single trap, there is a practical limit to how many ions you can put into it. Like I said, the most that people have done with really control is you know, around 14. But you know, that might be able to go up to maybe 40 or 50 ions in a single trap at most. And beyond that, well, they start to get too close together, and you get various bad crosstalk effects and things like that. And there's some other issues about scaling up within a single trap. So what people are talking about in order to scale this up is connecting up a bunch of different ion traps. So there's kind of two ways to do that. And so one of the ways of connecting up different ion traps is to just have kind of a big trap with different pieces in it. Okay, so it's kind of a segmented trap. And what they do then is they'll use lasers to grab one ion in that trap and move it around into a different part of the trap. Okay, and that way you could have kind of arbitrarily large traps with, you know, different trapping fields keeping the ions in different parts, and then you can have phonon modes in each of these separate parts of this bigger trap. And people have actually done this, not with 14 qubits, but in smaller things. So for the ion trap, that's kind of one way of putting all of this together and scaling up to arbitrarily large quantum system. And all these pieces have been done. It's just a matter of putting them together and building bigger and bigger things. So another way of joining up traps I'm going to talk about a bit later in the lecture, that involves using light to connect up separate ion traps. Okay, so but there's other things you can do. So sticking with atoms, there's also a big experimental effort based on optical lattices. So an optical lattice consists of an array of lasers. So what happens is if you have two lasers with the same frequency pointing at each other, you get, that's just a one-dimensional lattice where you have a standing wave where there's high field and low field points. But you can do it in two dimensions or three dimensions, make a three-dimensional lattice. And what happens is you can trap atoms at the lattice points, let's say the low field points. Those atoms can then serve as your qubits, basically. So for instance, again, you'd use the electrons. And these atoms are neutral. Then there's various ways of getting them to interact. But basically, they involve frequently bringing the atoms together, perhaps for some sort of controlled collision, or sometimes you use tunneling between the neighboring lattice points. In any case, the the point is you can kind of physically move these atoms around by tuning the lasers in the optical lattice. And that gives you a tool to control these things. But one problem with this type of implementation, okay, so one good thing about this implementation is that you can fill these optical lattices with many, many atoms, thousands, even millions, by starting with the Bose-Einstein condensate and kind of feeding it into the lattice. And by tuning the parameters appropriately, you can get these atoms to spread out very well. So there's like very close to one atom per site, you know, occasional defects. And maybe depending on the shape of the potential, you might have some places where there's two atoms per site. But basically, it's a kind of nice uniform way of getting lots and lots of qubits. But one problem is that because these atoms are separated by just one optical wavelength, it's very hard to interact with just a single atom at a time. Nevertheless, people have managed to do that. So that remains a possibility for building a quantum computer. But the biggest experimental effort in these systems is actually focused in a slightly different direction of not having a general purpose quantum computer that can do any quantum algorithm, but a quantum computer that's just very good at simulating Hamiltonians. And the advantage of doing that So the advantage of doing that in the system is that, well, a lot of Hamiltonians, a lot of times there'll be translation invariant Hamiltonians. They'll have the same interaction between, you know, all nearest neighbor pairs of atoms. And so that's something that you can do without having to do this hard thing of separating just an interaction for one particular atom in this big lattice. Okay, because you just want to do the same thing everywhere. And so the idea is then that this would be a good physics tool for seeing the behavior of some spin system. You can write down the Hamiltonian for the system. You can study it theoretically. But it's hard to study it computationally because, you know, on a classical computer, because quantum states can be hard to simulate. We'll discuss that particular issue more next week. OK? So enough for atomic physics. Let's move on to optical. So there's linear optics quantum computing. So usually abbreviated LOQC. And in LOQC, the qubits are just photons. I think most often they're stored in the path degree of freedom of the photon. So either photon is going in this path or in this path. But you can use polarization degree of freedom. And sometimes you want to switch back and forth between the two, which is not so hard to do. So photons are nice. They're rather cheap to get photons, although getting single photons is not so straightforward. One problem with photons is that they don't interact with each other very well. And so one of the surprising things is that it is possible to do quantum computation with just linear optics. Because linear optics is kind of inherently the non-interacting photons situation. But the thing is, you do have something, which is you have measurement. And measurement, and which distinguishes between zero photons and one or more photons, is already a nonlinearity that's enough to cause a kind of effective interaction between photons. So I'm not going to go into the details of that. But basically, using measurement and some sort of post-selection, you can make entangled states. And from that, you can kind of build up to do arbitrary quantum computations. So the advantages of this scheme, as I said, is that photons are relatively cheap. Linear optics is something we can do pretty well. It does depend on, I mean, there's kind of a lot of overhead. You need lots of pieces to do a single gate. And The problem is that getting single photon states, you need very good single photon states to make this work. That's not so easy. And you also need good detectors. I should say there's lots more that could be said about each of these implementations, but I just want to kind of give you a quick overview of the range of things that people think about. So, I mean, the common theme here, again, is that these are systems that are naturally pretty well isolated from the environment. So, so the electrons, I mean, the ion trap is kind of a very clean system. It's basically vacuum except for the few atoms that you've put in there. And so the ions, well, they can interact electromagnetically with the outside world, but that's it. And they don't even, the electron energy levels don't even do that much, very much. So this is a very clean system. The optical lattices is maybe slightly less clean, but again, it's a cryogenic system. And they're neutral atoms now. So even there, the kind of the stray electromagnetic interactions are not so strong. Photons, well, if they hit matter, they can interact strongly. But they don't interact very strongly with other photons. And that's kind of the problem with this system. But it's also an advantage, because it means that a single photon, as long as it keeps on traveling, is unlikely to really decohere very much. Depends on degree of freedom. And there's always issues, of course. But photons are actually a very good way to transmit quantum information, the flying qubits that we talked about yesterday in the six or six, the DiVincenzo criteria number 6 and 7. Okay, and so moving on, it turns out that nuclear spins tend to also be very well isolated from the environment. So nuclear magnetic resonance is a good scope for quantum computing. So there, the qubits are nuclear spins. And just in general, actually, spin states tend to be pretty well isolated from the environment, because, well, they can interact via some dipole interaction if it's a charged particle with spin, which generally it is. But that tends to be weaker than say, having an electron in position A versus position B. And so in NMR, what happens is, well, you have atoms. The nuclei have some spin, and that's the qubit. But the atoms also have electrons. And I said you can get a dipole interaction. You get a spin-spin interaction between the nucleus and the electrons in that atom. And then the electrons, well, they'll be in some sort of cloud. They'll interact maybe with electrons in the next atom, or the electrons will be shared between the atoms. And so if you have some chemical compound, the neighboring nuclei can interact indirectly via the electrons. And so that's how you can do two-qubit gates in the system. So actually, NMR, I mean, because nuclear spins are, in some sense, a very, very well isolated, very good system, NMR has been used in a variety of different ways to do quantum computation. So for a while, the biggest quantum computers we had were, in fact, based on NMR. They've recently been overtaken by ion trap. And most of that has been done in liquid state NMR. So I mean, you do that even at room temperature. You have some liquid sample of some molecule, frequently an organic molecule. And using techniques that are decades old, I mean, people have been doing NMR pulse sequences for a long, long time. And basically, they were always doing quantum computation without totally realizing it. But there are a number of tricks that you have to do to make it really look like quantum computation, where you can say, here's a circuit I want to do, let's do that. But those were worked out, and so this is kind of relatively easy to do. But there's a problem with scaling it up, because, well, there's a bunch of problems with scaling it up. Partly the problem is that you're doing it at room temperature. And at room temperature, well, the energy difference between the ground state, the down spin, you use a big magnetic field to separate the two directions of spin, and the energy difference between the down spin and the up spin is very small compared to the temperature. which means that these nuclear spins are doing, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff with only a small excess doing one over the other. And somehow you have to leverage this small excess to do your quantum computation. And you can do that, but it's, I mean, in some sense, it's very inefficient. But on the other hand, you have lots and lots of atoms in a macroscopic sample, and lots of molecules. And so, you know, there is still a signal there that you can see. But the problem is that this approach, well, like I said, there's a number of problems. But one problem is that this approach, well, it uses a molecule as your quantum computer, okay? And while there are very, very big molecules that you could imagine using for liquid state NMR, it becomes very difficult to deal with the individual qubits in this molecule, because you need some way of addressing them separately. It's not like the ion trap where you can say, I want to do this atom, I'll shine a laser on this atom. Because these are things that are just connected chemically in some molecule. And so the way they normally distinguish in liquid state NMR between different things is to have basically different frequencies to address each of the different atoms. And it's not so easy even to find, once you start to get to, you know, 10, 15 qubits, it's not so easy to find molecules that have 10 different atoms that are all separated enough in frequency that you can distinguish them. And it gets worse and worse and worse as you get to more atoms. So this is something that's kind of reaching the end of its run, because it's not very scalable. But the techniques that were developed for this are applicable in a lot of other systems. And one of them I'll talk about again later in the lecture. Yeah. What do you mean by an example? You mean what molecule? Okay, I'm not very knowledgeable about this. I in my lecture notes for previous year, I talked about alanine, which is a small amino acid. Basically, the atoms that they like to use, carbon 13 has a spin 1/2, and hydrogen also spin 1/2 nucleus. So hydrocarbons, you know, organic molecules tend to be good things to do. And you want it not to be too symmetrical, because when it's symmetrical, then the atoms are have similar frequencies or the same frequency. So the frequency of the different atoms is determined by their chemical environment. So you want kind of all of the atoms to have different chemical environments. And then you have to just kind of look through some list of known NMR spectra and say, that's the molecule I want. No, I think it's smaller than that. I think it's more like a test tube. And then there may be some solvent as well. That has no nuclear spin. It's liquidy, yeah. And they, like I said, they do this at room temperature. I mean, the explorations in quantum computing class will be taught by David Corey, who's an expert in NMR. I don't know whether he's going to be taught mostly about liquid state NMR or some solid state NMR. But he will be able to tell you much, much, much more than I could possibly. Okay. So there's other variants of NMR that are pretty interesting and continue to be of interest nowadays. So one of them is spins in silicon. So this was a big thing for a while, although it's kind of lagged since then. So spins in silicon, the idea there is you'll have some silicon electrodes, and you implant a phosphorus atom in each of these electrodes. And the single phosphorus atom, that's your qubit. And then using the kind of electrical connections of these electrodes, you can get these different atoms to talk to each other for two-qubit interactions. And so I think the thing that kind of torpedoed this approach is that they had a hard time getting the measurement to work. It may be there's still people working on this. I'm not sure, but I haven't heard anything about it for a while. And it just kind of fell behind some of the other approaches. like the ion traps and superconductors in particular. But one thing that is pretty big right now, or it has been for a few years, is NV centers in diamonds. So it turns out that so diamond is, of course, a crystal of carbon atoms. But it turns out that if you put a single nitrogen atom, kind of insert it into the crystal, then, well, nitrogen, so carbon has four electrons in the outer shell. Nitrogen has only three. So to complement the nitrogen defect, you're going to have a vacancy. And so that's the N is the nitrogen, and V is vacancy next to it. And so this NV center, the nuclear spin kind of around this center is extremely well isolated. And it has incredibly long lifetimes. I mean, so NMR, as I said, is pretty good. So you can get lifetimes sometimes on the order of seconds. But I think this NV center is you can get lifetimes on the order of minutes or even sometimes hours. OK, so I mean, this is, I think, the longest coherence time known is in these NV centers. I'm not certain of that, but it's certainly the longest one that people really talk about for quantum computing. And so, of course, the problem is that when these things are so well isolated, it's really hard to connect them. So, I mean, one thing is that if you can get two NV centers near each other, you can start to use the same NMR technique of getting the electrons to talk to each other and getting a spin-spin interaction. It's hard to manufacture things that have a whole, you know, array of NV centers in just the right place. So that's not something that can be done yet. But people are talking about other and thinking about other ways of connecting up these things and also kind of other quantum applications of using these as sort of quantum sensors where you only need one or two qubits to do some sort of measurement. And so there's a significant effort on these things now. And it may be, for all I know, that besides the really long coherence time, that it's just the, you know, the cachet of working with diamonds. So. Okay, so are there any questions, any more questions so far? Okay, so maybe then let's move on to some more solid state implementations. We were kind of getting into those some with the NMR. So one approach is people have looked a lot at quantum dots or other kinds of silicon nanostructures. So, you know, there's this huge computer industry that uses silicon and other semiconductors. And so one thing that's always been attractive for quantum computers is if you can build quantum computers using silicon or even just some other semiconductor, then you can take advantage of all of these manufacturing techniques that have been developed for regular computers and apply them to quantum computers. So that's something that's very attractive. And so one approach that people have used is quantum dots. So a quantum dot is some kind of little well of semiconductor material that can have, is sometimes called an artificial atom. And so you can have some energy levels and trap electrons in there. Usually the best thing to do is to put the qubit in the spin of an electron, because that's pretty well isolated. And then there's various ways you can do interactions. So for instance, you might have neighboring wells, and you allow some tunneling between them, which you can gate by putting on some, you know, voltage. Or you can use the Fermi exclusion principle, actually. Tunneling. But the problem, this is a technique that people still are working on pretty intensively. But again, it's not one of the leading ones. And the reason is that the ratio of decoherence times to gate times is a bit short. So they kind of a bit more noisy than some of the better systems. It's probably worth saying at this point that as I said, it's the ratio of decoherence times to gate times that's kind of the important thing that tells you whether you can build a quantum computer or not. And if you look at the actual decoherence times in quantum dots, they're quite short. Spins you can get, I mean, I think might be microseconds or even milliseconds sometimes. But you know, that's nothing compared to the seconds of NMR. So in general, these things, these implementations that I've been putting up, they differ by many orders of magnitude in the actual decoherence times. But the gate times also differ, right? So in quantum dots, the gates are very fast, maybe nanosecond timescales. So the ratio is good enough that you can do something. Whereas in say NMR, usually you're on the millisecond timescale to do 2-qubit gates. And so, you know, of course you need much longer time, decoherence times to get a good ratio there. Okay. And then there's the other kind of leading candidate right now with ion traps is superconductors. And there's a variety of different superconducting qubits. There's charged qubits and flux qubits, phase qubits, and so these different kinds of qubits differ in the actual degree of freedom that's used to store the quantum information that's used as your qubit. So for a charged qubit, it's basically the location of a Cooper pair. So you might have one well of superconducting material and another well, and if it's in the first one, you have one extra Cooper pair, and if it's either the first one for zero or the second one for one. And then flux qubits, the qubit is the direction of a magnetic flux. And it's a, you know, quantized magnetic flux, so it's something very small. So you'll have some ring of superconducting material with Josephson junctions in it. And if the flux is one flux quantum up is a zero, and one flux quantum down would be a one, for instance. And then there's phase qubits, which is the qubit is superconducting phase, again using a ring. And Josephson junctions are kind of a big tool. Sorry, you can't read? You look like you're trying to read what I wrote. No. So which part can't you read? You can read, okay. Yeah.
So could you repeat why exactly it's the qubits are the location?
Yeah, so the idea is that, well, of course you have a superconductor of lots and lots of Cooper pairs, but you know, you can arrange things so that there's kind of one extra Cooper pair that causes a, you know, an overall charge of, I guess it would be -2. And so you have maybe say two little islands of superconducting material, and depending on the circuit arrangement, this extra Cooper pair can move from one island to the other. And so you say, if it's on island one, that's a zero, and if it's on island two, that's a one. Okay. And so it's really the location of the Cooper pair that's. But this technique is, well, okay. So this technique is not very good, because having a charge in different locations, that's something that's very susceptible to decoherence, because it'll interact very easily with any kind of stray electromagnetic field you might have around. So so how do you do interactions between these superconducting qubits? Well, again, there's a variety of different ways. The details depend on exactly what kind of qubit you have and other things you want to do. But basically, they all use kind of similar techniques, which is that a Josephson junction can act as a nonlinear inductor. And so that lets you do kind of non-trivial gates and combined with kind of regular circuitry, electric circuitry, you can build up a full set of things and do universal quantum computation. So these superconductors are another really good candidate that people are working on now to build big quantum computers. I would say that probably they're the second right now to ion traps in likelihood of being built. So the one thing to bear in mind, I mean, superconductors, when you see them, you know, in kind of general discussion, you think of superconductors as an example of a macroscopic quantum phenomenon, right? Because you get this superconducting condensate of Cooper pairs that, you know, has no resistance. That's a very weird quantum property. Of course, it has to be very cold temperatures, but nevertheless, you can get huge numbers of Cooper pairs and such a thing. But the thing is that it's quantum in some sense, but it's not quantum enough for quantum computing. So for quantum computing, you actually need pretty small superconductors, and they need to be very clean. Because it's quite possible that you can have a supercurrent that's traveling through something, but it has a definite kind of classical value. And so, for instance, if you want to do a flux qubit where the qubit is magnetic flux in a ring, well, if you know which direction the supercurrent is flowing, that'll tell you what the magnetic flux is. Okay? And so what you need is a small superconductor where you can actually get a superposition of different flux states and of different directions of the superconducting current. And I mean, we can do that now. It's not such a big issue, but it just means that if you take, you know, kind of a standard off-the-shelf superconductor, such as it is, it's not going to be good enough for quantum computing. So this is still kind of on the forefront of research. Again, people can do it. They can do multiple qubits. People have done at least 3 qubits, I think more, maybe on the order of 7, the current generation, maybe order 7 with superconductors. But actually the number of Cooper pairs involved in superconductors is, I think, still on the order of millions. So it's still kind of macroscopic in that sense. Maybe that's more mesoscopic. But it's not truly a macroscopic thing yet. Okay, so that's kind of my survey of the different possible implementations that people have talked about. There's actually lots more implementations. You know, there's in quantum Hall systems, people have talked about using non-abelian anions. There's exotic things like electrons floating on liquid helium. There's lots of other stuff that's not on this list that are variations of things that I did write. And probably some more that I've just simply forgotten about or don't know about. But this kind of gives you an overview of the range of different ideas that people have put into thinking about quantum computing. And this, I think, covers the most of the main ones that people are working on. Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty good. I mean, I think both of these are pretty good. There's another variation called the transmon, which is kind of a hybrid where you put superconducting wells in some sort of microwave resonator cavity. And that's another good superconducting candidate. So I think there are different experimental groups that are doing things with flux qubits and phase qubits and getting pretty good results. Again, you know, I'm the theoretical physicist in this story. So what exactly the current experimental state of the art is, I don't know that well. OK? Well, OK, so first of all, that's a little difficult to do in the lab. But no, actually, I think what you've heard about is something different. So there's I mean, I don't know exactly what you've heard about, but what I've heard about is black holes. The black hole qubit connection is about entanglement. So there's some classification of, so there's extremal black holes, very small. Well, so extremal black holes have, charge or spin as kind of the maximal value allowed by cosmic censorship. So you don't have the singularity outside. And if you have very microscopic extremal black holes, you can do some classification of them. And it turns out that for certain types of these microscopic extremal black holes, the mathematics of counting how many types of them there are turns out to be the same as some particular form, particular formula for a type of entanglement. Okay, and so that makes people wonder if there's some kind of deep connection or if it's just a mathematical coincidence. So I would guess that that's what you've heard about. But I don't know for sure, of course. I haven't heard of any serious proposals for, or even really humorous proposals, now that I think about it, for black holes as qubits. I have this idea for neutrinos as qubits because they're so well isolated, but that's also not very serious. Okay? Other questions? Okay, so let me.
The spins and silicon one.
Try to spin.
Spins and silicon.
Spin and silicon, yeah.
Would that be utilizing some? How is it supposed to work? Is it supposed to
So the idea
more or
is.
less work the same as we have with our current
No,
computation?
it really wouldn't. I mean, so it the. The ma I mean, again, it's supposed to, because it's silicon, it's supposed to take advantage of the manufacturing techniques, but it wouldn't look that similar. So the idea is, maybe I can put it. Put it over here. So the idea is you'd have some sort of array of electrodes. So have maybe a line of these or a two-dimensional array of them. And you'd implant a single phosphorus atom in each one of them. Okay, and that's already a kind of a challenging. So these have to be very microscopic electrodes. So that's something where you can use the current manufacturing techniques to make very, very small electrodes. But then you have to implant these phosphorus atoms very precisely so that you know where they are, and they can't be too much variation because if one of them is all the way over here and one of them is over here, they're not going to talk to each other very well. And in any case, and then, but then to interact them by fiddling with the voltages on these things, you can get the electrons. I mean, it's a semiconductor, so electrons will be a bit delocalized, and you can get them to kind of spread out in a cloud, so that the electrons from this electrode and this electrode are overlapping, and that way you can get the interaction between them. So the details of that doesn't look anything like what happens in a regular computer. So it's, but I mean, but there is, to get this to work, you do have electrodes, you have wires that connect up to the electrodes to apply the voltages and stuff like that. And so that part would be somewhat similar. Again, not in detail, but in general techniques. Other questions? Okay, so so let me talk a little bit about, until we run out of time, about a couple of the techniques that are used here to that might appear in more than one implementation. And there's actually a lot of such techniques, but I'm not going to have time to talk about them all. So let's start with the ion traps. So I said there was a way to connect up ion traps with light. So how does that work? Well, so the idea is instead of trapping the ions in a regular magnetic trap, we trap it instead in we trap them instead in optical cavities. So we're still using magnetic fields to trap the ions, but an optical cavity has the additional advantage that the trap is surrounded by mirrors. Very, very, very good mirrors. And so that means if you get a photon, also the size of this trap is chosen to be some multiple of the wavelength of the light that you're interested in. And so if you happen to get a photon in this trap, it'll stay there for a long, long time in the optical cavity. Okay, but the mirrors are not perfect, so eventually the photon will leak out, and that's actually an important part of this scheme. So anyway, so we're going to have a couple of such cavities, and they have one or more atoms in them, and they could have photons in them. And when the light leaks out of these cavities, we're going to arrange that we try to collect it with some optical fiber, and then bring these optical fibers together and put them through a beam splitter. And then on the outputs of this beam splitter, we'll have a photodetector. Let's just put it on one. And so what does this do for us? Well, so what we're going to do is we start each ion in the excited state. And then we can look at the atom-photon energy levels, just like we looked like the atom-phonon energy levels yesterday. And using a similar technique, we can switch the information from being stored in the atom, ground and excited, to the photon mode. Zero, one. Okay, and so now we do this in both cavities, and so now we have one photon in each cavity. And this photon, these photons will eventually leak out. But it's very unlikely that they'll both leak out at the same time, because it's a random process. And so if we manage to catch it in the optical fiber, then we have two possibilities. So we have one possibility is where a photon is leaked out of this cavity, and it's in this optical fiber. Another possibility, and then there's still a photon here. And then there's the possibility of having a photon leak out of this cavity, and then it's in this fiber, while there's still a photon here. Okay. So basically, and the cavities are pretty much identical, so there's 50% chance of either of these cases. And then look what happens. So it goes through the beam splitter, and suppose we detect the photon over here. Okay, so first of all, it tells us that a photon just leaked out, but it doesn't tell us which cavity it comes from. And this is all a quantum process. It's not, I mean, I described it as probabilistically leaking out, but actually it's an amplitude for leaking out. And so what that means is that you actually have a superposition of the cases where it leaked from this cavity and it leaked from this cavity. And this measurement doesn't tell you which one happened. So you have a superposition of what's left over. So in the case where it leaked from this cavity, you have zero photons here and one photon here. And in the case where it leaked from this cavity, you have one photon here and zero photons here. So this is an entangled state. Okay? And so then you can put the entangled state back into the atoms. And you can use it, for instance, for teleportation. That lets you move data, quantum data, qubits, from one cavity to another. And so if each cavity has, you know, three or four qubits in it, you use one of them to set up these entangled states and the other two to do some interesting computation. And then you can connect up these cavities and do arbitrary quantum computations with data that's distributed among all of these cavities. Okay? So that's one approach people have used to connect up ion traps. Okay? Any questions about that? Entangled state. So the way I wanted to do that is basically to do this again, but in reverse. So just like yesterday, we have this, we look at the electron photon energy states, we get this ladder. And so if we have, so basically, so in this case, we have either one of these two states. And so by doing this transition, this one will stay put. This one will go up here. So this is ground zero. This is excited zero. This is ground one. Okay? And so by doing this transition, we can put the data from being stored in the photon, zero, one, to the electron, ground or excited. They're not exactly degenerate. I mean, you want them to be close so that you'll get a good interaction, but they're not going to be exactly the same, and you don't want them to be exactly the same for exactly that reason. There's other tricks you can sometimes do, even if they are degenerate. You can go through some third level or something like that, but typically they're detuned a bit. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so now let me show you a different technique that's so this technique originated with NMR, but it's something that's actually become a very widely used technique in a lot of different implementations. So in NMR, we have this problem. Well, there's a lot of problems in liquid state NMR that you have to overcome. But one particular problem that I want to discuss is that you have a coupling between neighboring nuclear spins because of the electrons around the atoms kind of overlap. So we have a spin-spin coupling. But in liquid state NMR, that spin-spin coupling is always on. So that means that doing two-qubit gates is very easy. Because you just have to wait. And this spin-spin coupling will do some phase gate between the two qubits. What's hard is not doing two-qubit gates. We need to figure out some way to turn off this interaction, which is really just coming from the chemical structure of the molecule that we're using. Okay? And it turns out there's a trick you can do to do that. So I'm not going to go into any of the details of NMR, but let's just say that 1-qubit gates are relatively straightforward in the system. You can use radio frequency pulses, which interact with the nuclear spins and do kind of arbitrary single-qubit rotations. Again, assuming that the atom has separate frequencies for each of the atoms in it. Using that, we can have a way of turning off the spin-spin coupling. So in particular, the spin-spin Hamiltonian is of the form Z tensor Z. So Z here is sigma Z, 1 minus 1 diagonal matrix. Okay, so in the Bloch sphere, this is, the North Pole, South Pole. And if they're the same in that direction, you'll get a +1. If it's negative, it'll be a -1. And so if you wait for some time t, you have the time evolution operator e to the minus I t z tensor z over h bar. Okay. And so the idea of this technique, which is the more general version, is called dynamical decoupling. But it goes by a couple of different names depending on the exact application you want. Is that what we're going to do is we're going to wait for some time t, and then we're going to do a single qubit gate, and then wait again for some times t, and then do another single qubit gate. I guess I've written it in the other way around, where we do a single qubit gate and then wait, single qubit gate and wait. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a single qubit x gate. And x is sigma x, so it's this matrix. And we wait, then we do x again, and then we wait. And so let's calculate what the effect of this is. Well, so what we've done is we've done, say, x tensor I, then we did e to the minus I t, space, zz over h bar, and we have x tensor I again, and we have another e to the minus I t z over h bar. Now, x and z anti-commute. And so if you look at this thing, it's going to be, well, it's a power series in z tensor z. And the even terms will have z tensor z to an even power. Z squared is the identity. So the even powers are just going to be the identity. And the odd powers, well, will have something z tensor z. Okay. And furthermore, the even powers will have I to some even power, which will be ±1. And the odd terms will have I to an odd power, which will be ±I. So the effect then of having x of this combination, x on both sides of this thing is, well, it'll go through the even powers without changing anything. The odd powers will change sign, which is the same as changing plus I to minus I, basically, because the odd powers have I's in them and the even powers don't. Okay, so what this gives you then is e to the plus I t z tensor z over h. So this thing up here is e to the minus I t z z over h times e to the plus I t zz over h. And that gives you the identity. So NMR people like to to draw this as some picture. There's a, it's easier. So if you think about a single qubit case, it's kind of easier to visualize what's going on, because then you can think about it as the block sphere. And so what you can imagine is that the basic Hamiltonian is taking a state that maybe starts this way, and it rotates for a while, okay? And then you do some reflection, and then it continues rotating, and it ends up back where it started. Okay? And so that's what this pulse sequence does. And there's more generalized pulse sequences that can similarly turn off other kinds of unwanted Hamiltonians. Okay, so this dynamical decoupling is useful in NMR because it lets you turn off these unwanted ZZ interactions and lets you not do a two-qubit gate. But it's also very useful for getting rid of unwanted noise of various kinds. So for instance, if you have some sort of systematic error where you're constantly doing the wrong thing, well, by doing the right sort of dynamical decoupling sequence, you can, you know, if you over-rotate a little bit this time, then you switch it around, and your over-rotation will cancel out the next time. It can turn off kind of constant interactions that you have with the environment, which would normally cause errors. But using dynamical coupling, you can cause them to turn off, and then they're gone. Now, the catch is that the interaction that you turn off has to be slowly varying, because you need the same thing to be happening here and here, in the first weight sequence and the second weight sequence. And you can have longer pulse sequences to make this work sometimes. So if the Hamiltonian, the interaction, the unwanted interaction Hamiltonian is changing over time on a time scale that's kind of comparable or shorter than the thing that you're doing here, then this is not going to work. And similarly, if what's going on in the environment causes it to change, so you get effectively different interaction from that, then that can also cause problems. So this doesn't solve every problem of noise, but it does get rid of a big class of noise. And so self-correcting pulses, dynamical decoupling, this is a very widely used technique in all sorts of different implementations. Okay, so that's it for today, I guess. Are there any questions on dynamical decoupling or any of the other stuff we did? Okay, well, tomorrow we're going to start on a new topic of computational complexity, and from there lead into quantum algorithms next week. Okay.